Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, everybody. As you may hear, this is not Andre Hakes. This is Bruce Williamson. And I'm sitting in for Andre Hakes here on Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And here with me today is John Zwirling. John is a noted, successful lawyer in Alexandria, Virginia, and in Charlottesville, Virginia. And John has been at this practice of law for a few years, and he's here to talk about the law, social justice, and some of his interesting cases. Good morning, John.
Morning, Bruce. How are you?
Doing well. How are you, sir?
Great.
Good. So, John, when did you start practicing law?
1970. I went to American University Law School. I passed the bar December before I graduated in Virginia, and I've been practicing in Virginia ever since.
And has your practice been essentially restricted to criminal law?
I'd say 99.9% is criminal, and the rest is related to it, such as civil rights and things of that nature.
Well, in your practice, have you had people in your personal practice who have been exonerated?
Yes, of course.
And of course. Now, when you say of course, what do you mean by that?
Well, over 40 years, you got to have some success.
I'm sorry. Different question. People who are not who found guilty, but later on exonerated.
Well, one case in particular, I didn't do the trial, but there were four fellows who were convicted of murder in a racial situation in D.C. They were members of a biker organization called the Pagans, and in 1975, they were all convicted of murder, sentenced to life. Turns out that they were innocent. The Centurion Ministries out in New Jersey became interested in their case, and after a number of years of investigating it, asked me to represent them. And I got involved with Wilma Cutler. Art Matthews was a great attorney there. He agreed to work on it with me. And it took us 15 years of litigation, but eventually they were exonerated. They got letters of exoneration, and they were pitifully reimbursed by the U.S. government for between 20 and 30 years of false incarceration.
So how is it that people who are charged and found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt are sent off to prison even though they're innocent?
Well, people are presumed to be innocent under our system of justice. That is on paper. In reality, most jurors believe that if somebody is sitting at defense counsel's table, they must have done something wrong or they wouldn't be there. There's a presumption that they did something wrong that is different than a presumption of innocence. And in voir dire, which is when the lawyer questions the jury about their understanding of the law as explained by the judge and the predilections and prejudices, you can point to the defendant and says, who here understands the presumption of innocence? That is, he sits there, he's presumed to be innocent, and you can't convict him until the Commonwealth puts on enough evidence to convince you that he did the crime. And they all raise their hands, they all know that. And then you say, well, do you understand that that means you are presuming that he's falsely accused at this moment? And the judge goes, Mr. Zwirling, come here. You can't say that. I go, why can't I say that? That's exactly what the presumption of innocence means. You're casting dispersions on the system. Duh. But you can't explain it that way. But in a case that I had out of Fairfax, the judge went through her voir dire. Actually, it was Judge Roush who made it up to the Supreme Court for a short period of time. Terrific trial judge. And she did her voir dire and, you know, asked the jury if they could be fair and impartial to both sides, if they had any prejudices or strong feelings against either side. And everybody, no, we're fair. We can be fair. Everybody thinks they can be fair. But then on voir dire, you have to explain to them that what the question really is whether you have a rooting interest. You know, you can be a fair and impartial person, but if you're a Nats fan, and something happens, and they call you out of the stands to call balls and strikes when the Nats are playing the Mets, nobody would think that that would be a good idea. You shouldn't be the person calling balls and strikes because you have a rooting interest for one of the teams, no matter how hard you might try.
So when you're trying to select a jury, as a lawyer, you're asking potential jurors questions. You're trying to identify what their biases might be, or what their exactly. opinions may be that are formed before the trial that could interfere with their ability to be
right.
fair.
So in this particular case, the client I was representing had traveled from New York down to Virginia to have a sexual encounter with somebody he met. His position was he believed that it was an adult playing, role-playing as a juvenile. And the Commonwealth's position was, well, the police officer said he was a juvenile, and so the defendant had
and the
reason,
police officer was playing the role
playing
of
the
supposed
role
juvenile.
Of the juvenile, and the client's position was that he knew it was an adult. He was just hoping it was going to be a woman when he got there.
And not a male police officer.
Not a male police officer. And he didn't really expect it to be a minor. Well, that was the issue for the jury to decide. So what was in his mind? So I asked him on voir dire, after they had been qualified by the court and by the prosecution as being fair and impartial, to put themselves in this position at the end of the case, after they've heard all the evidence, after they have discussed it among themselves, after the judges instructed them on the law, after they've heard all the arguments from the prosecution and defense, this is where they are. They believe that it's more likely than not that the defendant came down to have sex with a minor. But they're also strongly of the belief that the Commonwealth had not proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Would they have any problem finding the defendant not guilty because of that reasonable doubt, even though it meant probably putting a pedophile back on the street? And a third of the voir dire, a third of the jurors then and only then raised their hands because they finally understood what the presumption and burden of proof meant.
Do you find that most judges you practice in front of let you go that thoroughly into explaining the presumption of innocence to a jury panel?
I've never been cut off. Not since I passed the 20 years of practice and started being as old or older than the judges, okay? And that does make a difference. And
yes, it does.
But my belief is, as long as the judge wants to hear the answer to your question, he or she will allow the question. When you start getting into, well, what magazines do you read? What bumper stickers do you have? That their eyes glaze over and they cut you off.
Well, that's something that the lawyers listening to should listening to this show. Should keep in mind when they're asking the questions to try to frame something that the judge will want to hear. Once more, this is Bruce Williamson sitting in for Andre Hakes on Straight Talk on 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, here with John Zwirling. Now, John, let's talk a little bit about exonerations. There have been many stories about people who are exonerated. I think that the number in Virginia since track has been kept of these statistics for a few decades is between 40 and 50, but some of the cases are very, very well known. But nationwide, according to the National Registry of Exonerations at the University of Michigan Law School, what's the current number for exonerations nationwide?
Slightly under 2,000.
Okay. And of those, well, has it been your experience that many people believe that those are all because of DNA? I'm not talking about what's actually so, but in the public perception.
I think that probably yes, because the average person can understand that DNA, or they have greater faith in DNA than some lawyers do, but they believe that it's a scientific test that can either show you were there or show you were not there. And so it's easier for them to understand it and accept it.
There's some objectivity to it.
Correct.
Much like whether someone is on videotape entering a store, for example, when it's a robbery.
Because then it takes a human being to make the identification.
Yes. So we have some statistics here from the National Registry of Exonerations. I wanted to ask you to comment about these a little bit. And that is that on the general point I want to discuss with you, John, is that the criminal justice system is a human system. And as a result of that, it's subject to human frailties, and mistakes are made. So according to the National Register of Exonerations, how many factors are they identifying as significant factors in exonerations?
They have identified five major factors.
And what are those factors?
Well, in order of the number, it would be perjury or false accusations would be the number one. Number two would be official misconduct, which a lot of people have difficulty believing.
And that would be misconduct either by prosecutors or police officers.
That's correct.
Or by laboratory personnel sometimes.
Right. Mistaken ID is the third. False or misleading forensic evidence that is not the product of perjury or bias on the part of the examiner. And false confessions is about 12%.
And I see from these figures that some of these overlap so that they don't all add up to 100%. But perjury or false accusations have been determined in between 50 and 60% of exonerations. Is that
correct? That's correct, yeah.
And then official misconduct in just a shade over 50%.
That's also correct.
Whereas they've found false confessions in maybe 12 or 13% of the cases.
That's right. But that's a really startling percent, because most people, and I've had this problem in my practice, where a client, I'm convinced, gave a false confession. Jurors said if it's something important, nobody would ever confess to something they didn't do. And in point of fact, the police interrogation techniques are so good at this particular point at extracting confessions that in many instances they can get somebody to confess to having committed a crime they didn't commit, because it is the most attractive course of action under the circumstances that are created for them. For example, just tell us you did it and you can go home today. Okay, I did it. That's a blatant one, but it does exist.
Well, does that one tend to work more with people of limited intelligence?
I can't say that. The case I had with the false confession that resulted in a conviction, unfortunately, the fellow was a very, very bright gentleman and a scientist. But his real-world experience was limited to the point where he fell for that particular out.
And what are the sorts of techniques or manners are used by police to get false confession? Or to get, I don't want to say they're attempting to get a false confession, because would you agree that in most of these instances, the police officers have focused on a suspect who they're interrogating, that they have come to believe that that person either committed the crime or quite possibly committed the crime, and so they feel justified in interrogating the person, sometimes over a significant period of time, employing various techniques that we're talking about to try to get the person to confess, but with the belief that if a confession is extracted from the person, that it's the truth.
That's right. They think they're doing the right thing. And they have less faith in the system's ability to function without these techniques. than they should.
Well, having to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt on evidence other than an admission is a more difficult thing for a prosecutor to do than proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt with a confession.
That's right. Now, in this particular case, the client said he did not do it. He started out saying, I did not do it. I did not go into those apartments. I did not accost any of these women. And they just kept at him. They told him that his fingerprints were found in the apartment. Well, the perpetrator wore gloves. If he was the perpetrator, he would have known he wore gloves. But he believed that his fingerprints somehow were in these apartments. He couldn't figure out how.
One of the themes in these techniques, isn't it, is to create a feeling of hopelessness
right. In
the mind of the person who's being interrogated. They figure that no matter what, guilty or not, they've got evidence on me, and I'm not going to get out of this without admitting what I did.
That's correct.
Or admitting that I did something, even if I didn't do it.
So they finally got him to believe that his fingerprints were in these apartments, and that the only way they could have gotten into all these apartments is if he, in fact, was the perpetrator. So to reconcile the two, he started saying, well, I don't recall doing it. Well, once he started saying, well, I don't recall doing it, now he has acknowledged that maybe he did do it, even though he has no memory of it, and that's because he didn't do it. But now he thinks maybe he did do it, and he just doesn't remember it. And eventually, they get him to say, well, I'm sorry, I apologize to these women for what I must have done, and then eventually it's to what I did do. Now, when these interrogations were not videotaped or tape recorded, the police description of it would start with, sorry, I did it, etc. Fortunately now, in many jurisdictions, they do show the entirety of the interrogation. And in others, they just start at the point where he's about to confess.
Having had a significant discussion with the individual for quite some time to cue him up for the supposed confession.
So the jury is deprived of the ability to see how the individual who may have been innocent was manipulated into saying they did it when, in fact, they did not do it and certainly did not have any belief in their own minds that they did it until the belief was erased by lies by the police, which they are allowed to do. They are allowed to lie to a person they're interrogating.
The United States Supreme Court held that many years ago.
That's correct.
The police have schools that they go to, don't they? There are courses that detectives and other officers can take in interrogation techniques, and there are a couple of different schools of thought within the law enforcement community, within the teaching part of the law enforcement community, to teach people how to interrogate witnesses to elicit confessions.
Right. And if you watch Law and Order, you can see some of these, the Reed technique, for example, where they'll tell a person who says he didn't do it that, you know, he needs to man up and admit it. And everybody will understand why he did it. He did it because this person was threatening his wife or was doing something bad, and he was just standing up for good.
And you didn't mean to kill him. Meant to defend this person, and it's okay with the hand on the shoulder. It's okay.
We understand, but you need to tell us. This is your last chance, really, to get it off your chest, and, you know, we'll make sure the judge and the prosecutor know about how cooperative you are and the circumstances. And, of course, once you do that, you're done.
Now, of course, those techniques oftentimes elicit confessions from people who actually have committed the crimes that they're being interrogated for, and they have elicited many truthful confessions.
Oh, I'd say the vast majority are truthful confessions. The problem is, do we care about the innocent people who are convicted based on false confessions using these very techniques?
We're back. Again, this is Bruce Williamson, sitting in for Andre Hakes on Straight Talk, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, here with John Zwirling of Zwirling, Citron & Berg, Alexandria, Virginia, and Charlottesville, Virginia. John, we were talking about false confessions and about confession techniques. Would you agree that one of the reasons that confessions have been so valued over the years is going back centuries to the point where most people in our society, going back to England, Anglo-Saxon, American Anglo law, everyone believed in God. Everyone had a religious belief, and they believed that no one would lie, and they certainly would not lie under oath, and that if someone did confess, it meant that they were guilty.
Well, as the late departed Justice Scalia put it, confession is good for the soul, and we should encourage it, not discourage it.
Well, and certainly, as any criminal defense lawyer knows, you know it, I know it, that we oftentimes get into cases after the person has done what's good for the soul, making their defense a whole lot more difficult, but making the law enforcement job a little bit easier. But how do we go about trying to distinguish in trial preparation and in presenting a case to a court or a jury between a false confession and a true confession?
Well, it helps if you can find extrinsic evidence to defeat some of the things that are in the confession. For example, police get him to admit that he drove his Jeep Cherokee to the scene of the crime, when in fact the Jeep Cherokee was in the shop. Okay? In a case that we had years ago here in Charlottesville, Valentina Jelibova, she was interrogated for 9 hours, and it was videotaped. And you could hear the officer using these techniques, telling her she's lying when she says this, lying when she says that, and she says, check my credit card. You know, we never use cash. We charge everything. And so I know we were there around noon. Well, at trial, we went through that entire statement, and every time she said, check my credit card, we showed the credit card receipt, and lo and behold, she was being accurate. Mm-hmm. So even though those were minor contradictions of the officer's belief that she was lying, we were able to show that she wasn't lying. It gave an undercut the Commonwealth's ability to say, well, the whole statement was true, and that then which is true and which is not true.
Well, let's talk. Excuse me. Let's talk briefly about the death penalty. I don't wish to.
But before
just
we
to
leave,
take,
this,
oh, sure.
Can I just say one other thing about
please.
Talking to the police, even if it's not a confession? Golden rule: if you are ever accused of having committed a crime, the police want to talk to you, is to say you want to talk to your lawyer. Be firm. Don't be afraid. Because it's in the end, it's not so much what you tell the police that is going to hurt you. It's what the police say you've told the police that is going to hurt you. And oftentimes, it's close, but very different. And the example that I use is for anybody who's seen the movie My Cousin Vinny, you'll see when the sheriff...
I shot the sheriff?
That's right. When the sheriff approaches these two young men in their car...
Well, let's do it. When he's interrogating him, he says, you shot the sheriff. And the young man says, I shot the sheriff? I shot the sheriff? But at trial, when the deputy is recounting it, he says...
And the defendant said, I shot the storekeeper.
The storekeeper.
That's right.
I was thinking of the song and not the movie, but yes.
Right.
So the incredulity in the voice of the defendant when he's asked it in the police station or the sheriff's office without a recording isn't conveyed to the jury by the officer who's recounting it.
That's correct. And that's the problem.
People oftentimes seem to feel guilty. They are made to feel guilty. They are looked down upon when folks talk about people appearing before Congress. They say, he took the Fifth. In other words, mm-hmm. he asserted his civilly sacred right to not incriminate himself, but it's made to sound like a bad thing. And of course, the public, we're totally free to draw negative conclusions. If someone takes the Fifth Amendment when they're asked a question, the answer to which we'd like to know, or it's a question of public interest, would like to know that. We can draw those conclusions. Jurors aren't free to draw those conclusions.
No, but, you know, the Fifth Amendment is you have the right to remain silent and that no adverse inference can be drawn from your exercise of your constitutional rights, including the Fifth Amendment. But people believe that it is solely to prevent you from incriminating yourself, which means getting yourself involved in a criminal proceeding, admitting guilt of some type. Supreme Court has made it very clear that you can assert the Fifth Amendment right, even though you have not, in fact, committed a crime. Most people don't know that, and if they do know it, they don't accept it.
Well, they say, well, if the police are interrogating him for a robbery, and he has some explanation to indicate he didn't commit the robbery, well, why wouldn't he tell them?
And the reason is, it's not what you tell the police, it's what the police say you said. And once you start down that road, they can lie to you, they can trick you. Mm-hmm. You are so much better off having your lawyer intervene between you and the police.
And even if you don't confess, you can have a lengthy discussion with the police about what you did that day, where you were at the time of the robbery, why you were there. But sitting in a police station under interrogation in a situation where the police are familiar with this sort of interaction, this is their shop. They're very familiar with interrogating people. People aren't so familiar with being interrogated or even having a discussion with the police where they may be accused of a crime. Then later on, any subsequent statements the person might make, for example, testifying at trial, there may be little inconsistencies between what they told the police and what they said at trial, and those can be pointed out and used against them.
That's right. That's very true, Bruce. And the advantage about not making a statement when you're first approached by the police under any type of situation where you are being inquired of because of possible involvement, you are at a huge disadvantage when you're in custody. And the purpose of Miranda, the rationale for it, for people to be advised of the significance of talking to the police without an attorney, was mandated by the Supreme Court because of the very position that most citizens would find themselves in when they are interrogated. They're frightened. They don't understand really what's going on. They don't necessarily know what their rights are. But even if they do know what their rights are, it is to drive home to them that this is serious business. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. That's supposed to have the effect of driving you back to say, well, geez, maybe I oughtn't say anything. And unfortunately now, everybody knows their Miranda rights because it's on every television show that you watch that's a cop story or movie. And police nowadays oftentimes say, I know that you know all this stuff, but I'm required to tell it to you. And then they just read it off a card so fast without any emphasis on anything that it diminishes the purpose of being read your Miranda rights.
So let's talk a little bit about the right to counsel. Under the Constitution, people have a right to bring a lawyer to court and to represent them. But until the early 1960s, people who could not afford to have a lawyer did not have the right to have a lawyer. The famous case is Gideon versus Wainwright. I actually was acquainted with John White, John Davis, rather, who is the father of a woman I practiced law with for a number of years, Susan White, who's here in town. And John was the clerk of the Supreme Court, and he opened the letter from Gideon that led to the case that established the fact that if you're accused of a felony in the United States, not just in federal law but in any state, you have to be afforded counsel if you cannot afford to hire counsel.
Well, now, as long as you face incarceration.
But there was a period of time of about, Gideon was in the 64 or so.
Right.
And Argersinger against Hamlin was around 72 maybe. So there's a period of time where people were still being put in jail until Argus Singer against Hamlin came out, and then that was extended to any crime, including misdemeanors, for which you may be incarcerated.
Correct.
So before then, people oftentimes would march off to jail without a lawyer.
That's right.
But some states, even before Gideon against Wainwright, some states did afford counsel to people in felony cases. Is that correct?
You say so.
Well, let's say, I haven't researched it, but I hope so. But certainly we know it was not the case in Florida, because that's where Gideon came from. But when people have court-appointed counsel, in Virginia now, many jurisdictions, but not all, have a public defender office. And statistically speaking, those offices tend to handle about 75%, more or less, of the court-appointed cases in the jurisdictions they cover, because there are conflicts of interest, multiple defendants in a case that require outside counsel. Is there a strong training and experience requirement for court-appointed counsel in Virginia?
No. But jurisdiction by jurisdiction, they require different things.
Virginia has a minimum requirement now. There's a small level of CLEs that you have to have done to be on the court-appointed list, but it's not significant.
Well, CLE is a continuing legal education,
yes, sir,
program. Oftentimes it's on a tape recording, and you're supposed to listen to it. You know, some people are very conscientious and work hard, whether or not they're court-appointed or not. In fact, most. And most of the public defender's offices have training programs and are very good. Alexandria and Fairfax, for example, have terrific public defender's offices. I mention those because I'm most familiar with them.
But even in those cases where the office is good and it's led by an outstanding lawyer and administrator and the lawyers are good, they also have a significant number of cases, don't they?
They do.
Difficult for them to devote as much time as they might wish.
Well, look,
to each case.
I would rather have a good public defender's office, if I didn't have any money, represent me, where they have investigators, they have office staff, even though they're overloaded, than some public defenders who don't have private investigators have to go to the court if they feel they need one, who are maxed out at $1,000 on a felony as far as compensation is concerned. If you can't afford an attorney, you know, you are at some jeopardy compared to those who can. You know, not everybody can afford the O.J. Simpson defense, okay? But it shows you what you can do with enough resources, how you can win an unwinnable case.
Well, of course, it didn't hurt him, in addition to his resources. It didn't hurt the fact that some evidence was moved around and otherwise handled in the way that shouldn't have been handled.
My take from the O.J. Simpson case is the one thing it proves is that just because you're guilty doesn't mean you can't be framed.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's a phrase we've used before discussing that case.
Right.
And a jury may have acquitted Mr. Simpson because they felt he truly didn't commit the crime. I hope that that's so. But they also may have thought, you know, he may well have done it, but we're not going to convict him this way.
Right. We're not going to let him be framed.
And while we're talking about that case for just a moment, lawyers are capable. A good friend of mine, Steve Helvin, is a retired judge here locally, had a phrase. I'm sure it wasn't original to him, but he taught it to me, which is that a good lawyer isn't going to win a lot of cases, but you sure can lose a case as a lawyer. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the first part, but the second part, you sure can lose cases. Marsha Clark and Chris Dodd pulled.
Darden.
I'm sorry?
Chris Darden.
Darden, thank you. This whole thing with the glove. The glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Now, lawyers cannot think things through sometimes, in that case, the prosecutor, to take a glove that was soaked in blood, dried and shrunken, and try to fit it on the hand of the person who did it, rather than using your unlimited resources as a district attorney to fly in the person from Italy who made the gloves, measure his hand, compare the size, and state whether or not that glove would have fit him. Surprising things happen in court. I'm sure that the defense team was delighted with that turn of events.
Right. They should have used the identical glove that was new that they did put into evidence that they had gotten from the store where they had the receipt showing that it had been purchased by Miss Brown, I think, for OJ. But, you know, defense attorneys, myself included, sometimes do stupid things too.
We all make mistakes. And speaking of people who go to court without training, sometimes lawyers and young lawyers handling serious cases, it's almost as if you take someone right out of medical school and say, "Will you please remove this appendix?" I mean, I was 2 years out of law school. I tried my first two juries with no real support, and in retrospect didn't know what I was doing. Fortunate enough to have acquittals, but maybe in spite of what I did rather than because. And that happens. We see that. We see inexperienced lawyers in court, and you have to gain experience, so you have to try. But it's unfortunate that in some jurisdictions will appoint an experienced lawyer and a less experienced lawyer in serious cases. And that's a wonderful way to afford.
Where's that other than in death penalty cases?
Oh, that's happened. I was involved in two cases last year just like that.
In state court?
Yeah, me being the graybeard. In those cases, and the other lawyer having less experience.
It shows you how good Charles Phil and Albemarle are.
You're right about that. There's no question about that. So let's talk for a few minutes about some of the interesting cases that you've had in the past.
Okay.
So in terms of not just legal interest, but listening value for those folks out here listening to this, any particular cases of yours come to mind? You know, I have one in mind we talked about before, but any other cases that come to your mind that might be good stories to share?
Other than one you want me to talk about?
And I don't mean war stories per se, but yeah, war stories.
Well, I've had over the years some very interesting cases, but a lot of them are lawyer interested and not necessarily listener interested.
Well, of course, one of them landed you in a book.
Which one?
You were mentioned in a book just a year or two ago. I'm sorry, this is not coming to my mind. I thought it would come right to yours.
No. What? Give me a hint.
All right, we're going to go to a break for a second. John and I are going to try to get our heads together.
All right.
Hello, Bruce Williamson here again for Andre Hakes on Straight Talk. On 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, here with John Zwirling. John and I just flubbed a question for John, but John, there's a book called Jackpot, in which you were mentioned. Can you tell us very briefly what led you to that that level of fame?
Jackpot was the name of a police investigation into a couple of very, very large marijuana smuggling groups. And the prosecution was in South Carolina. And there was Jackpot 1 and Jackpot 2. And in Jackpot 1, there were four attorneys. All of us knew each other and had done cases together. Bill Moffitt and John Flowers Mark, myself, Larry Turner. John Keats was involved in the case. It was a lot of fun. And all of our clients, all four of them, were acquitted or had the cases dismissed with prejudice in Jackpot 1. They were then charged in Jackpot 2, which was an overlapping marijuana thing. And we all had double jeopardy arguments saying can't be prosecuted twice, having been acquitted once for the same crime. So our trial was about double jeopardy. And So we didn't have to fight the facts. We didn't have to fight whether they were innocent or guilty. We just had to have the judge determine whether they were the same conspiracy or not. And one of the stories that comes out of it, I'm cross-examining a witness, and the witness is telling a story completely different than what the agents had testified to. And I said to him, well, is somebody had testified that A and B happened, and you're saying A and B didn't happen. What would be your explanation for that? I hear objection, Your Honor, improper pitting. Sustained, says the judge. And I look over to my buddies, and I go, big shrug, what the hell's that all about? And they go, big shrug, we have no idea. So I said, Judge, can you help me out? I don't want to make the same mistake twice. What is improper pitting? He goes, well, you're improperly pitting one witness against another. I said, I thought that was the art of cross-examination. He goes, not in my court.
It's one thing to ask a witness their opinion of a prior witness. That's clearly not allowed. But improper pitting, let's hope that the prosecutors here don't pick that up. And if they do, the judges let them drop it. So let's talk about another case that, you know, I've been interested in, you discussing in the past, involving the Internal Revenue Service and a well-known organization called the Church of Scientology.
Okay, well, this was a long time ago, and the prosecution took place in D.C., and the allegation was that the church had gone into the IRS and stolen investigative files and things like that that had been gathered against them. And
the IRS was gathering these files against the church,
right,
in order to reach a determination as to whether or not the Church of Scientology was in fact a bona fide religion and therefore
right,
not subject to taxation.
And so what was happening was the Church of Scientology in Hawaii would be denied their tax-exempt status by the IRS. They would go through 2-3 years worth of expensive litigation and discovery. And then on the eve of trial, the IRS would dismiss the allegation and allow them to be tax exempt for that period of time, and then file a complaint against them for the succeeding years, saying that they didn't qualify. And this would go on and was costing the church a huge amount of money.
The church no doubt felt that was just harassment.
They did, and they decided they were going to try to prove it. And so what they did was they sent in some moles into the IRS. My client got a job in the IRS as a clerk down in the D.C. headquarters. Lenny Koenig, another attorney's client, was the personal secretary. She'd gone in and became the personal secretary to the Nathan Dodell, I think it was, who was the Justice Department attorney in charge of all the litigation against the church. And my client figured out over a period of time, allegedly, how to get badges made for other people to come into the IRS at night. They went in, they Xeroxed.
Well, now, hold on just a sec, please. When you say these people, one person became a private secretary, another became in a different position, this is something that was going on over a period of years.
Yes, it took years. And
an extended operation.
They needed to, the people who went in needed to figure out how to get advanced to the positions that they needed to get advanced to, and they did. And so eventually the members of this organization went in and Xeroxed every sheet of paper they could find in the IRS files in the headquarters of the litigation between the IRS and the church. And the private secretary for the Department of Justice attorney in charge would give them information as well. And they planted a bug in the IRS conference room and listened to and tape-recorded conversations of the IRS and the DOJ when they were figuring out their strategy on how to go after the church. And they got prosecuted for that. Apparently, the government was not happy when they found this out. And it turns out the only thing they were able to convict these people of was stealing the Xerox paper.
Now, all the facts that you've just discussed, these became known
through the
in the course of the trial.
The litigation.
The civil litation or the criminal?
Criminal. Okay. Criminal. Mary Sue Hubbard got probation. Some of the others got 2-3 years.
For stealing Xerox paper.
Stealing Xerox paper.
And so how did it come about that stealing Xerox paper, I mean, obviously the import of the paper to the Church of Scientology was not the actual paper itself, but what was photocopied onto the paper.
They couldn't convict them of the information that was Xeroxed because it wasn't classified.
It was?
Wasn't classified.
There was no crime.
Had they brought their own paper in?
There was no crime against basically getting access to the IRS offices under false pretenses and photocopying IRS records?
Apparently not. Because they would have been convicted had they been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now, let's go back to a more... not that that wasn't a serious matter to the Church of Scientology and to the IRS. And back to that for just a second. Did the Church of Scientology succeed in maintaining its tax-exempt status?
They do now. They are an established religion.
And they have since then?
Yes.
A relationship between that case and that success?
I can't say.
All right. So let's talk about a more serious topic, even though that was serious to the Church of Scientology and the IRS. And that's the manner in which the criminal justice system deals with people who are either mentally ill or who have Asperger's syndrome or other similar conditions. Mm-hmm. I understand you've had some experience in these cases. And let's talk about people with mental illness first.
Okay. There's a huge number of people who are serving time in state and federal prisons who suffer from mental health problems, some of them very serious, some of them not as serious, but which still has a causal relationship to why they're incarcerated. And the one I'd like to talk about are people with Asperger's syndrome. And
talk a little bit about what Asperger's syndrome is.
Okay, it's on the scale of autism, and it's at a lower level. It's away from people who can't communicate, who maybe bang their heads against the wall and have to wear helmets. I mean, there's a whole range of seriousness of Asperger's.
And that's what's referred to as on the spectrum?
Spectrum, right. Yes. And the individuals with Asperger's that I've come in contact with, and I'd say in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe 10 of these young people, all of whom have gotten in trouble for being in their basements and watching pornography, and some of it eventually is child pornography. They have no social outlets.
Because they would not get in trouble with the law by watching
just
non-child pornography.
That's right. So, and invariably they have difficulty making friends because they're off-putting in their presentation. They don't understand satire, humor,
sometimes
because everything is black and white.
Sometimes they don't pick up on social cues.
Right. For example, during one of the interrogations, police officer said to this young person, "Are you still in school?" And he said, "No, I'm here in the living room with you." Okay? Because he took it literally. And so people just don't necessarily understand that. They don't have a lot of friends.
But before we proceed with this topic, I just want to say that this is Bruce Williamson sitting in for Andre Hicks. 94.7, Straight Talk, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Thanks. And they get caught up watching child pornography in their basement, you know, through some police techniques, which are perfectly legitimate. But the courts don't know how to deal with
them. When you say police techniques that are perfectly legitimate, you mean police techniques that are aimed at detecting people who are using child pornography?
Right, who are downloading child pornography. For example, they'll bust a site that distributes or has peer-to-peer file sharing. like Napster used to be, only this is for everything, and including videos, including pornography, including child pornography.
Referred to as the dark web in some...
Not necessarily even the dark web. It's just
short of that
out there. And then they will get a search warrant. They'll go in, they'll arrest the guy, and then they'll talk to him, separate him from his mother, get him to make a confession. And then for receiving is a five-year mandatory minimum. And
now, it's a five-year mandatory minimum to receive an image of child pornography.
Yes.
Now,
I think it has to be three or more, but still.
And then what is the age of the person depicted in the pornography that qualifies as child pornography?
17 or under.
So if someone receives an image, a sexually explicit image of 17-year-olds engaging in sexual activities, and they receive that on the computer, they have a minimum 5-year prison sentence.
Right. Possessing it
now, what if,
has no mandatory minimum.
But receiving it
has
now,
five.
What would the penalty be if the individual at his computer, rather than engaging in receiving that pornography, went not to a website but to a Starbucks and met a 17-year-old person and actually engaged in sex with that 17-year-old person?
That would be a misdemeanor contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
So actually having sex with a minor is consensual sex is a misdemeanor, maximum penalty of 12 months in jail.
If the minor is over a certain age.
Yes, but it's 17-year-old, yes. 16-17-year-old.
Right.
But receiving images of that person, 5 years in prison.
Correct, even if they send it to you.
Okay, so let's go back to the discussion of Asperger's, please.
So we had a case here in Charlottesville, and he wound up with a significant sentence. And the judge, strongly recommended he be sent to Butner.
Now, this is a federal prosecution.
And what is
Butner?
Butner is a federal correctional institute that also has a hospital and where they can treat people who have mental problems as well as physical problems. And it's a safer environment than a medium security facility. Bureau of Prison sent him to a medium security prison, sent him on this bus where you're sitting there with bank robbers and murderers and whatever. He didn't present well. He was abused. He wound up having to be in solitary confinement for months. Mm. The judge had to intervene a second time, and they finally sent him down to another facility where they also have a sex offender program so he wouldn't be isolated. And he's there, and he's not being properly medicated for his obsessive-compulsive disorder. He's getting no real treatment for his Asperger's, and he's just being warehoused. And when he comes out, it's going to be, he's not going to have anything happen to him other than be abused by the system. They're just not sensitive to dealing with people with mental illnesses. And the Bureau of Prisons says they don't even keep track of how many people with autism get sent to them for treatment.
Have some judges looked at that and disposed of cases or try to deal with these cases in a different way?
Yes. There are some judges who have refused to sentence people until the Bureau of Prisons will tell them exactly where they're going to send them, what programs are available, so that they are convinced that they're not sending this person to be mistreated and suffer what might be considered cruel and unusual punishment for somebody with that condition.
Such a person would have been tried and convicted.
Or pled.
But had been found guilty.
Right.
But after that, there would be a pre-sentence report, but the judge would not actually pronounce sentence, which would be the judge's final act, entering a final order with sentencing, but rather keep the case open and have the person be on some sort of home incarceration.
Right. Or if there's no mandatory minimum, sentence them to home confinement, even though the guidelines, which are the recommended sentence, might be 5, 10, 15 years but that is so rare. And there are so many people who are being sentenced to this cruel outcome that there's very little that we can do about it.
Well, this is the topic of mental illness in intersection with criminality certainly is in the newspapers all the time. Every time there's a shooting, there seems to be a discussion of mental illness and or jihadism. But those are sensational cases. You're talking about things that happen on a regular basis, more everyday life.
Right.
Things.
And when we're also not talking about insanity defenses. We're not talking right now about utilizing the mental illness to change the charge, but to utilize it to determine what is an appropriate sentence for this individual under the circumstances of the case and the person's situation. And the problem is, when there are mandatory minimum sentences, the courts are powerless to sentence a person to a just sentence. They just sentence the individual.
And that is something that's wholly different from insanity as a defense. You're not talking about something that will have some be found not guilty.
That's correct.
But can be sentenced in a way that is not only serving the purposes of sentencing, punishment, for example, but also trying to put the person in a position where they will be less likely to offend in the future.
Right, which is better for society, better for the individual, just not better for the politicians who like mandatory minimum sentences because they don't trust the judges.
Well, mental health and the law and other topics maybe we can explore another time. But for now, thank you very much to John Zwirling for being here today on Straight Talk. Again, this is Bruce Williamson substituting for Andre Hakes. And to all, happy 4th of July weekend. Thank you again, John.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.